under the title of euthanasia. Paul Bowe and Fritz Norsted will start it off. Okay, Paul? All I might say is that maybe the origin of this came out of a session last week in which, or about the conclusion of it, we mentioned the rising concern, awareness of the problems of euthanasia, and maybe a larger demand even for euthanasia on the part of people. At least more consideration of the rather distressing topic. We also, at the same time, we're talking about cremation and the increasing use of cremation as a way of hastening rather than delaying the returning to dust process. But that's not particularly included in tonight, but we do want to talk a little bit about euthanasia. Last week, there was a person here in the village who came up and talked about her own distress. I thought she had been married to a pastor who for 17 years had been suffering from Alzheimer's disease, and who for the last 4 or 5 years had been in rather acute suffering. She herself in great distress. The possibility of communication was about gone. He had pleaded repeatedly in recent months, in the last year for the blessed death. And she had hoped it would come, and then felt guilty over wishing that it would come. She told me that she had some children, and she gave me permission to talk about this tonight. She had some children who strenuously objected to giving up any possible means to keep him alive. So there was tension within the family over this. The wife, ready to let him go, and perhaps out of very profound love, hoping that there would be a way. The children, not wanting to part with their father, and standing in the way of complicating the situation because of tensions then that rose right within the family. Then there was a tension also between the woman and the doctor that had been serving them so very well for a long period of time. The doctor wanted no part of any withdrawal of maximum support for this man. 5 or 6 times in an 18-month period of time, he had developed pneumonia, and there was treatment, intensive treatment of the pneumonia, which kept him alive. Otherwise, he would have died. She wanted to know if it was possible for her to demand that there be no antibiotics or no treatment of the pneumonia if it happened again, and to let what has sometimes been called the old person's friend to take him. But again, the guilt feeling started to roll in. You know, here she was doing less than everything possible to save him. And I think that what she was talking about here in the village last week, in discussing this not only with me, but with quite a number of other people, brings in some of the dimensions that people are facing more and more these days. One of her last statements to me was that she could understand, she said, it's a terrible thought to know, that I can understand and sympathize with a man down in Florida who shot his wife. Then she cried out in an agony, "Why is it necessary to go to such extremes?" And I think that's probably where this topic could be leading on. Okay, Paul, the rest of the evening's yours.
When Fritz invited me to participate with him in this, I told him that I had more questions than I had answers. And so I think that I would like to pose a number of questions and have this be a forum rather than a presentation by Fritz and me, because I think all of you have had experiences or do have experiences that touch you very deeply, and you probably have insights that are as valuable as any that Fritz and I might propound. So I'd like to just cite three instances in my own personal life that get at some of the things that Fritz is talking about and raise some questions for us. And I'll try to put the worst case first, or I'm not sure which is the worst. It's a difficult thing. Some of you knew Eleanor Bockelman, a very lovely woman who was a colleague of mine in the national office at the American Lutheran Church. She worked in my office for a number of years before I left the national office. Sometime shortly before I left the national office, we began to notice that Eleanor had a few problems. A rather traumatic meeting had taken place, and Eleanor had gotten so disturbed that she the next day she couldn't remember anything about the meeting. And we began to realize gradually that something was wrong. Ultimately, Eleanor was diagnosed as having Alzheimer's disease, and gradually progressed into a state of inability to recognize family and friends, inability finally to communicate effectively. And for 6 years was in a nursing home, the only place she could be taken care of. It left her husband, Bill, who many of you have read in the Lutheran Standard and so on, who's a writer for the American Lutheran Church, in the awful position of having to pay out more each year in fees to the nursing home than his income was, and having to supplement his income in one way or another to try to keep Eleanor going. Finally, Eleanor died, but it was a very difficult and painful kind of situation over a period of years. That's one thing. 2 years ago, Carola and I were down in Arkansas visiting some very dear friends of 30 years stature. They, together with another couple, and Carola and I took a float trip down the White River in Arkansas, a rapid, fast river. We had a couple of boats and a couple of guides, and we had a marvelous day on the river fishing. Last spring, this man, who was so vigorous and outgoing and loved life, had a heart attack and then a stroke, and then they tried to do a bypass operation on him, and he had another stroke, and since then he's been in a vegetative state. Practically no hope, according to the doctors, of his recovering of his mental faculties. A third instance, a colleague of ours at the national office, a younger couple, had a son who was about 16 or 17 years of age. This is some years ago. He went out on a motorcycle one night, hit something, flew over the handlebars, lit on his head, and broke his neck. They called me, and I went out to the hospital. We were out there with them. And while we were sitting there, the doctor came in and said, he's brain dead. We've got him on respirators. We've got him on a heart machine. And we can keep him going indefinitely. And then he said, he's in good health, and we need his organs. that there are many people waiting out there for organs such as he has. Your son is essentially dead. What do you think we should do? And we had a painful several hours talking about this, and finally they decided to tell a doctor to pull the plug. And when they did, we got up and went back to their house and sat there for about 3 or 4 hours, mostly in silence, and finally the phone rang and the doctor said he's gone. And his organs were then taken and used for transplants. Now, this poses some very difficult questions. And I'm sure many of you could use the same kind of illustrations. Now, I'd like to just say one more thing, or I would want to say it, but I'd like to read something. Carola and I happened to notice in the Minneapolis Star and Tribune last week an article on the editorial page by former Senator Jacob Javits. Senator Javits is about as well known as any senator in our country. And this is what he writes. I'm not going to read all of it, but I'm going to read the introduction. I may be terminally ill, and he apparently is. I therefore face in an intimate and personal way the issue of my right to die. I am happy for those who are not ill, but they are terminal too, and should think about this question as it relates to themselves and those they love. The issue first received serious attention 10 years ago when a New Jersey court granted Karen Ann Quinlan's parents' request to remove life-preserving support from their comatose daughter. Since then, there has been an intensive inquiry into the ethical and legal aspects of the right to die. The issue is whether a terminally ill patient may confer the authority to withdraw his life support. This is generally done by means of a living will. And then he goes on at some length to talk about living wills and to advocate that everyone who is still in command of his or her faculties ought to think through this question, consider it with loved ones, important people in one's life, decide whether or not one wants to live under certain circumstances, and then confer the authority for terminating that life on someone who can take that kind of responsibility under whatever criteria are set forth in the living will. So this question of euthanasia, or the question of how to terminate life, is a very intricate question, but one which confronts all of us, I think, in many, many aspects of our life. Fritz, I'd like to ask this question, and I don't know whether you want to try at it or whether maybe some of the other people in the group want to try it, but what really is euthanasia? Is it the man in Florida who takes the gun and shoots his wife? Or is it the case of the doctor in the case of the young man whom I cited who carefully questions the parents and carefully examines the patient and comes to the conclusion that the person is already essentially dead? Or is it the case of a living will like this? See, what are we talking about when we're talking about euthanasia? Would you like to comment on that, or should we
just very briefly? I think that by and large, people are more ready to think about the type of euthanasia that's sometimes termed passive euthanasia, where you don't pull a gun. That would be active euthanasia in an extreme and rather bizarre way. But passive euthanasia is when you stop doing something, knowing that the result, the effect of your not doing may bring on and hasten death. Now, by and large, the passive euthanasia is not as difficult to accept, of course, as active euthanasia. But I think that maybe a little bit later on, we might want to even consider talking a bit about active euthanasia, not pulling out a gun and shooting, but possibly some other ways in which we may someday want to consider it. Again, what Paul said before, that we have a whole lot more questions than we have answers, and we share those with you people, so start raising the questions and give us the answers.
Can I give one final comment before we start raising questions? Some of you may remember 2 years ago, I think it's 2 years ago, or maybe it's three, Governor Lamb of Colorado was giving a speech about the resources of this country, and pointing out that rapidly we are beginning to exhaust the resources of this country. And then he turned to older people. He didn't specify the age, but he indicated older people. And he said, "We need the resources that you are using. Get out of the way," in so many words. In other words, what Governor Lamb was saying to those of us who are past 70 years of age, drop dead. Now, here's a responsible elected governor of a state making a thoughtful speech.
A little later on, I want to argue this one, but not now. What do you want to talk about?
What might be the religious objections to my putting in my living will that if I get Alzheimer's disease and have no longer any control of my faculties, that a serum be injected into me to end my life?
You're making a big leap all of a sudden, aren't you, on this thing? We're past the passive euthanasia and into the active euthanasia. All right, where do you want to go with that?
I don't think it's legal.
I don't think you could get a doctor that could do it.
Yeah, he wants the theological reasons against that.
Is that what you're asking?
I was asking,
or should the law
change? Religious objections to that.
You're talking about religious objections to it.
But I do agree with a lot of the doctors that pneumonia is man's, the sick people's friend. And I know a lot of our biggest medical schools in the United States honor the living will, and they will not tell the local doctor, do not give anything if you get pneumonia, that nature take its course.
Plus some other categories closely related to that, where there's an order written on the chart, do not resuscitate.
But I like his question about the theological implications.
Well, I think if you ask a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old about that, and the simplest and first thing they might think of would be the admonition to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And so their answer would be yes, no problem.
I might heartily agree with you, but that would shorten the session too much if we leave it right there.
I have a question. I have a living will, but I've been told that is not always the people, that's not necessarily what's going to happen in a case of something. I haven't even thought about a serum injection, but if you had a living will, could your children do something about not doing if they wanted to? Is a living will really a legal thing?
It is some places semi-quasi-legal. Other places has no legal standing. But I think that any attorney would say it is a guide, but you better not rely on it in any absolute sense. And I don't think I would want it relied, would you? In an absolute sense, as though you could sort of look ahead and know all of the circumstances, maybe even all of the wondrous advances that medicine can make between now and then, it may alter the situation a bit. To me, the value of the living will is that it is usually discussed with your loved ones. So they know your will. They know your feelings about it. My family knows it. Goodness sakes, I've told them 100 times that if they keep me going past any time when it's meaningful at all, and where it starts to deplete what little I can leave to them so they can survive on this planet a few more years. If they do that, I'll haunt them. They just better not. Well, the theological. See, the thing is, theology doesn't speak to it, does it? Or it hasn't. Has it? It has, I haven't found it yet. So we can form the theology, but right here tonight, and have an exclusive on it, so let's go.
If you legalize abortions, I can't see where there's any different there than letting another person take control of his life at any one time. They can legalize it one way, they should not hold any laws that they say a person can't control his own life.
Well, in the Catholic faith, Fritz, isn't it that a suicide will not expect to go to heaven?
Well, I don't know what Catholics are expecting these days. I hope that our Protestant churches grow as fast as Catholic churches have developed in the last 20 years. They've been the ones that have been shown the movement, perhaps more than we have. So I don't know what Catholics are thinking about things like this today. Maybe nobody knows. Maybe they don't know themselves, because there's so much movement among the laity also and among our theologians. Suicide. Now you've brought another word in, Gene. Is euthanasia suicide?
Yeah. Well, the one he described where the man requests the injection or even has it prepared and gives it to himself. It was, at least some years ago, I understood that a Catholic could not be buried in consecrated ground.
It used to be that way. Also
now,
among Lutherans.
I wondered what the stand was now, or what the stand of the Lutheran Church is, if any.
I haven't taken any firm on
that. I don't think the Lutheran Church has any stance on that subject at this point.
No, the Lutheran Church is relying on you in a way of sort of evolution to start developing thinking on these things. And when consensus is strong enough, it may influence some of the practices of the church, and maybe some statements that we make in somewhat official way without making them a category of doctrine. Would you like to have let's jump to his question here, tangentially at least. Would you people like to have a pill that you could take or somebody could administer to you if you come to a place where there is intense suffering, intense financial drain, no hope of recovery within any reasonable parameters? Would you like to have something available or have something available for your loved ones to use? Or is this repulsive?
Yes.
You say yes.
You would like to have something?
We had a former
U.S. in
prison.
I didn't hear
you, but said we had a former Eurasian in prison camp because of the...
Have many of you had to make a decision like this, say in your own family or loved ones?
I've had a really interesting experience with my father. He died last December 29th, and he had emphysema, and he'd suffered for many years, and he just said over and over and over again the last 4 or 5 years that he'd like to die. And my mother would always just raise all kinds of cane about that and say, just urge him on and say, every day is a victory. And every day, you know, it's something really special. And anyway, his answer would have been yes, that he would like, had liked to. And but I can't contest in any way the way it finally happened, because he said, why am I still living? Why am I still here? And toward the very end, it became really clear that the rest of us weren't ready to let him go until that time. And so And so on December the 29th, Christmas was out of the way. All the family was still on hand. It was as though he had timed it just to perfection. And I was with him. And it's just like every breath that he took, they were counted on that last day. He exhaled, and then he just like magic, he just flipped, gone. And it was just incredible. So his answer would have been that he would have liked to, but it wouldn't have been appropriate. He told me, he said, one time he said he would shoot himself in a second, but if it wouldn't disgrace the family. And so all this mix of things went on for all those years, and it was really marvelous the way it finally ended.
You're among the fortunate ones.
My husband died from emphysema too. And at the last, he was like, he wanted to die for years. And at the very end, he had contacted hepatitis. And so the hepatitis with the emphysema, and he was brain dead before he actually died. And my son had been to the hospital and had talked to the doctor, unaware of what I had said, and said, if my dad has to be a vegetable, will you let my mother pull the plug? And I had the same thought in mind, but we had not even consulted one another. But fortunately, he died. But we would have requested that.
In a sense, I had to pull the plug on my daughter. We mentioned this a little bit in another connection. But something that was said a bit ago reminded me of a thing that she had said to us. She said, let me out of the hospital, let me go home. I've been under the treatment now for 2 years. You know, the doctors know, I know, that this is not working. She had seen too many of her fellow patients hospitalized with exactly the same disease die. And so she knew something of the pattern that was taking place within herself. And so she said one night, tomorrow or day after they're supposed to start another treatment, and that means another month of sustained life probably, and another month of some suffering also, and another month in which she thought would simply be delaying the inevitable death. So she pleaded with us to come home so she could enjoy life for a little while. Well, the methotrexate was not knocking her out so badly, and before the cancer got a chance to catch up and take her, and she wanted some time to have some fun with her child and with her family. And we protested this, and then she said, and with some of you may remember Sue, she was a rather gentle kind of a person, but like most of the meek of this world, back them into some kind of a corner and they start to rise up with some amazing strength. She sat up in her bed at the Passland Hospital in Chicago and looked at us, her mother, her preacher husband, and her preacher father, and said, now, all of you get out of my room, now. Don't you dare come back in here until you reconcile your own death, and then we can talk sensibly about this. It was a long time before her father got taken.
Of all the people in the United States that have been active in euthanasia since 1920, it's been 56. Over half of those have done it since 1980. I lean, of course, towards the passive biomedical limbo. I had an aunt that decided for herself when she was stricken with a stroke, she was not going to lay in that bed as a vegetable. And therefore she decided not to eat, and she didn't. And eventually death came.
I think Fritz posed the question earlier whether if a pill could be made available, would you like to have it? I think that there is a difference, certainly, between that method of euthanasia, let's say, if that is euthanasia. And on the other hand, what Jacob Javits is talking about here is making a living will which sets forth for some responsible person, whether it's a doctor, a lawyer, or a minister, or a family member, or what, certain criteria that one has thought out in advance.
Which could make use of, however, an injection.
Certainly, you know, it could, yes. But which is decided upon rationally in advance with someone who is responsible, willing to assume that responsibility according to certain criteria which are agreed upon. I think there's a difference between those two.
Oh, yes, yes indeed.
I think I'd have some difficulties, even though I were in extremis in one way or another, in administering, let us say, a pill to myself. Emotional overlay. So many doubts that have come up out of exposure to different points of view and theological formulations.
Would you let Corolla do it with a doctor and some other loved ones around making a decision?
I think I would find it much more acceptable to have someone under those circumstances working under certain criteria that we agreed on in advance.
That's where it would work.
Than to ask me to face the question of taking my own life under those circumstances.
Well, for one thing, to have a pill like that in your possession in moments of extreme despair and despondency and so on, you could take it where if it was more difficult, you'd probably weather it through and come out of it.
Well, a patient would very rarely, you have to stretch your imagination and think that a patient would be in a position to make that decision. So when I'm talking about having it available to the patient, I'm not talking that it necessarily is something that he himself would reach over and take. Although I think there could be circumstances where that would be a good thing to do too. Great. Well, you're not unaware of the fact that sometimes orders are given for morphine, for instance, where you realize that it's at least running a strong strong risk of being an overdose. It's done in mercy when it's done. I don't think I've seen this abused, and it's done in mercy. But where the pain or the suffering is so intense that such decisions have been made to make it available. The ones I feel sorry for are you nurses in that situation, because you sometimes have to do.
The poor doctor we face maybe a few times in our lifetime, but just think, he would face it maybe once a month.
Many times.
I've seen more often, I work in a nursing home where we do have many terminal patients, and I've seen more times doctors being very reluctant to order almost, you know, we just have to have enough pill, pull and bake to try and get orders for enough to relieve the pain, because they're too afraid of that it would kill them. And then they're afraid of
malpractice. Doctors are in a very, very tough spot today. We people have done that to the doctors. We've increased the cost of medical care so fantastically through malpractice.
I wouldn't want a pill that I could take. But if my heart stopped, I wouldn't want the nurse to quickly run and get him and start my heart again and leave it. And same way with pneumonia.
Would that be if your heart stopped tonight, would you want that to just be left?
Because
no resuscitation.
Usually when they bring them back with the brain damage and all this and that and the other thing, and I'd rather be dead.
Watch it.
I went through it myself with my wife. She had a brain tumor, very unusual brain tumor along the Parkinson's. And the Mayo Clinic told the local hospital that she's going to die one of three ways: lung failure, not be able to swallow and starve to death, or a heart attack. And they say, if she gets pneumonia, do not use antibiotics. She died of a lung failure.
Yeah.
But that she had a living will.
Yes, and that's kind of situation. But for instance, I think, now I'm in favor of having my family make a decision and tilting towards euthanasia, passive sort at least, with me. But for instance, if I had a heart attack tonight, I think I would want to try resuscitation for a couple of minutes, no more. And because so many people come back so wondrously afterwards. Or how about a child or someone who has a heart stopping? Obviously, in situations like that, you want to do everything possible to get them pumping away again, don't you? But if this happens after I've had considerable deterioration, then I would think it would be a merciful thing if you would not resuscitate. My family understands this, and I trust them to act within the framework of my wishes, without saying that my wishes are the governing wishes, because their wishes are just as important as mine.
I think that one of the problems we're dealing with here is that that the prolongation of life, and you're talking about pneumonia and so on, the prolongation of life has come out of much scientific research, has come out of the development of many different types of medicines, and the development of a variety of machinery, if you will, which are able to sustain life beyond what would be the natural, normal course of events. And so one of the questions, I think, that occurs to me as I think about this whole business is that if man is able to, by rational procedures and mechanical procedures, to prolong life beyond the natural course of the event, ought man to be able then also to make the decision to cease and to stop that? And where does the question of natural death come into the picture? I think it's a very difficult kind of question.
I was faced with a somewhat different situation. My husband had been bedridden for 8 months with terminal cancer. It spread all over his body. Fortunately, it was a miracle, the cancer had hit the part of his brain that controlled pain, and he felt no pain. He had no pain through all of it, and he had the most painful kind of cancer. So I was able to keep him at home. I was able to take care of him. But of course, being bedridden so long and so on, he got bladder and kidney infections. And we were giving him antibiotics to control this, but there was no hope for him as far as anything other than just holding the infections in abeyance. And on a Friday, the visiting nurse always came on Tuesdays, and on a Friday, I was giving him his medication, and he said, and we were never able to talk about his death. I asked him once if he wanted to talk about it, or if he wanted to talk about it with someone besides me, if he had any wishes or anything, and he refused to even discuss it. So, but he was lucid right up till the time he died. And so on this Friday, he said, what are you giving me? And he hadn't eaten me. All he could do was drink and sugar. And I said, well, this is an antibiotic. And he said, what's it for? I said, well, you have bladder and kidney infection, and this will help with that. Well, he said, what would happen if I didn't take it? I said, well, you'd develop uremic poisoning and you would die. And he was still a moment, and he said, well, don't give me any more. Now, the man was not in pain. He was not using up what we had left for me to live on. I was able to take care of him. And what do you do in that case?
What did you do?
Well, the Lord delivered me from having to make the decision. he had taken the last of his medication. He was going to be tested again the following Tuesday, at which time I would have had the medications refilled and continued or stopped. Sunday before that Tuesday, he died in his sleep.
I think there's a big element of we're choosing our own death. We have a choice. And there's a, it seems to me that there's a point where we know that we're facing death. There's with elderly people, they often stop eating, don't they? Because
yeah,
they're ready.
There are some. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask the question, what would Jesus say to the issue if he was here today?
I don't really know what Jesus would say to the issue. I do know this, that I feel that Jesus talked about life as a continuum, not merely the life we live in this world, but the life which is eternal, which is lived with God, and how he would have viewed the termination of this part of that continuum as over against the continuum into eternal life. I have a difficult time understanding that. I'm not sure. In many ways, Jesus, I think, indicated that this life is not the most important thing in the world. That is just to live it out physically.
Mm-hmm.
And that
and we're in such a materialistic world.
Yeah.
We're putting the emphasis on that materialistic
mm-hmm.
aspect.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I suspect if he was here tonight, he'd say, are you living in a consciousness that I am indeed the resurrection and the life, or is that something has faded way back in your brain and you hardly even are aware of it. If you are aware that he is the resurrection and the life, then perhaps he might also suggest to us that we're developing an almost neurotic concern for keeping this life together in terms of respiration and heartbeat at almost any cost, even if it comes a kind of an obscenity, as sometimes happens. I had to face this one night, and as I told some of you before, and decided that Sue was not going to be fed anymore. She was entirely dependent upon, if she was going to live at all, even for more than a day, she would have had to have had some intravenous injections to feed her, to keep her alive, and she was on that borderline of starvation because she had trouble swallowing. Doctor said, you'll have to decide, do you feed or not feed? But Susan had made me promise something, and I was bound to it, and I kept my promise. So, no feeding, and she died before 24 hours was up. Then, now that is a little bit more aggressive than simply letting somebody go. We knew that the result of the action was going to be death within a few hours.
No intravenous feeding, or?
No intravenous feeding.
Yeah.
She was at home, wasn't she?
She was at home, mm-hmm. or she wanted to die. That's a good place to be when you die, by the way, instead of some sterile hospital.
Well, that happened. Excuse me. My next door neighbor was having trouble. He's only 45, and his wife is a nurse, and he was at home, and the oncologist did give her enough morphine, so she was overdosing him. But he was lucid at the end, and it was, the children were all there, and we were there, and it was a nice way to go. But I would take my hand out to that doctor forever because he did let her overdose him. And I know they put malpractice to him.
And now this fades over a little bit closer to active euthanasia, doesn't it?
But he was in pain.
What do you think of this now? See, this is what we've talked about, several kinds of passive euthanasia, a little bit about some active, you know, here's a specific case that would cross over the line perhaps to active.
I wonder if it's possible to make flat statements where it really needs to be looked at as a individual statement happening in each individual case, rather than saying, you know, how do you feel about this for this person, for that experience, that was the correct way. The other thing I'm thinking about too is the living will, and that my children do have a right to override my living will. I'm not sure how I really feel about that. I don't like that idea. I want to make my own choice. And I've made it. Mm-hmm. And I don't want them to override me. But I don't think that my flat statement says that all living wills have to be handled this way.
Oh, no, of course not. But what you are saying, you see, you're making a strong statement here, I think, about the permissibility of these things. And perhaps this is about where we are, a lot of people wondering if it's even permissible to think about passive euthanasia and consenting to it, or even active.
Well, I was thinking that on the cases where it borders into active euthanasia, I think it ought to depend on whether the family, in their heart of hearts, is kind of wanting to go ahead and end it for their own convenience so they can get on with their lives, which I'm not saying that's not valid, but if that's the motivating force, which is primary, then the answer answers itself. And if the primary focus is on the person they love, then again it answers itself. They go ahead and do it. In the latter they ought to think real carefully about it. If the former, matter of their own convenience is in their thoughts mostly.
But that's where I think the living will is good, if in case of myself with my children. If they know how I felt about that, then they would sort of feel more like, well, we're not just trying to get rid of her or something, if it had been talked over ahead of time, because they would know what my desire was. And I think that if I, you know, living today, I would know that they weren't doing it for that reason. I think that's where, when you say talk about it ahead of time and discuss it.
But can a living will get into the subtleties of these borderline questions? Can a living will get into the subtleties of saying, let's, you know, consider the use, please, of 100 micrograms of morphine, you know, per, you know, it comes down to a value judgment in the end anyway.
Jacob Javits, in this article, further down in the article, he's discussing living wills, seems to favor the thought that the person or persons who ought to have the authority to make a decision should not be family members, but someone else who after conferring with the family can make a decision, which I think he is trying to protect against certain abuses that might take place, or over-emotionalism and so on, that might take place on the part of family members having to make that kind of a decision. He seems to favor a physician, a lawyer, a religious advisor, or some such person as that, who would make a decision. Then he says, if the family disagrees, they might have resource to the courts. This is his point of view.
I think that the medical profession is in a bind. Most of you, when you mentioned, it's well to be at home, but how many physicians will treat a patient in the home, even if they're old? It's hard to get them, many doctors to get even to nursing homes. And those that do, perhaps are a little older too, but if they do that, then there's three or four people that happens along in a course of a fairly short time, considering why the other members of the profession will say that he's doing it and it gives them a bad name. Don't use that. And there's a certain ethical background among the doctors themselves, and it puts them in a bad light with their colleagues. And for them to make the decision, if they have a number of geriatric patients, which many have, and other younger men do not have them, why, it puts them at a disadvantage. It's difficult for them from their own professional stand, and the oath they took years ago, many of the old ones still abide by it.
This is my gentleman.
As a physician, I might disagree with that a little bit. I feel that the most important thing is there is an expression by the family and by the individual, because we as physicians nowadays are put in a corner by our lawyer friends, and if there's an expression, then, and it's documented, then it's much easier for us to condescend to that will, whether it's dying at home in the right setting, dying gracefully in whatever setting you want to. My view of it is that it's very important to have some expression by family and the member to allow the physician to go ahead. And then if you're taken to court, you by some dissenting member of the family, you have some means to justify that, and it probably won't go anywhere. It makes it much easier for us as physicians once that's established.
There's another thing that makes it easier for physicians. If you have a physician who knows you,
right. Mm-hmm.
Now, the changing pattern of healthcare delivery has made it so that less and less frequently does the doctor know us well. He may know our liver very, very well, because that's happened to me especially, or the kidney very, very well. And if we play the organ of modern medicine by saying, well, I got pain here, that's, I go to the left hand in the back pain specialist, and if I've got a pain here, I go to the head specialist, and if I got pain in my hand, I go to the hand pain specialist, or if you play the organ of it like that, then you have to face this time of death without having someone who knows you, perhaps knows your will, knows your family. And having spent so much of my life so close to some of these situations, I would just plead with you to have a physician who knows you and is close to you. Let him help you call on the specialists and play that big, magnificent organ that's available to us today. But when you come down to a thing like we're talking about tonight, it would be nice to have a physician friend who can help the family carry out your wishes and your family's wishes. It's a harder thing, and most likely you'll find that the doctors that don't know you will want to turn away from this and not help you very much with it, because they don't have any basis for helping you. I hope my physician, my primary physician, is nearby when I approach these hours, because I know that I'm not going to be able to make a good decision on it, and perhaps Gertrude won't be able to. She may have too many tears in her eyes to read the signs quite the way they ought to, but she can tell them the will. And the main value is living will. Don't count on a living will to settle all these details and all these circumstances, these nuances that you were talking about. Impossible to nail down 10 years, 20 years ahead of time. It is the intent that you have that becomes very, very important.
Well, don't you think, too, it helps with any the sense of guilt that family does feel in these instances?
Of course.
It seems to me that those people who care about each other in a family situation, let's say in an ideal family situation, and you do care, that if you would take the time and the energy to discuss along the way as you're living, whether you're my children's age or what age you are, that you will pretty well know what each of you wants. And the fact that people actually do, in whatever painful situation they're in, live until the family is willing to let them go. It seems to me that if you would talk this out, even though I'm looking at it on a non-emotional level, it seems to me that that would be a much more profitable way to allow the family to let you go and you to go. because those of us who are choosing to not let you go are allowing you to continue to suffer for whatever reason is mine.
Maybe for selfish reasons.
Yes, well, I didn't want to say that, but
yes, maybe for
that's where it's coming from. And that's certainly valid. That's certainly valid.
I have a friend who's just now being kept alive. In fact, he's closer than a friend, a relative, who's being kept alive because nobody wants to let him go. And he's in intense suffering. But nobody wants to take the responsibility for saying, let him go. His will has been carefully expressed, eloquently expressed, agonizingly expressed. But everybody tries to keep him alive, but for their selfish reasons.
Yeah, okay, so then what about the responsibility that they've all taken upon themselves to hold him here? What do they do with that feeling? I mean, that's worse than letting him go.
Well,
you
may
think
so.
It's worse, but they don't necessarily think it's worse.
The people who...
How do you validate that to yourself? Right. How do you hold on to that and say?
See, it's harder, it's easier to fault a person for letting a person go than it is for keeping them alive. See, it's easier to fault a person. It's much more acceptable to keep a person alive than to let him die or to help him die, huh?
That's changing.
It
has changed considerable. I find very few people in that category today.
Is that right?
I find most people are willing to say, if this person is no longer able to recover, hold the blood and let them go. I find very few people wanting to hang on because of the economics of it, primarily. You know, wipe out their whole life.
I think, did you want to say something?
I was just going to comment or defer to a physician any day. I'm a veterinarian. Worked with Leo Bustead a lot, and I have been the anesthesiologist on some experiments that were being done for heart work in man, but we were working on dogs. And I've carried a dog along for a long time. When I know the head, the whole head, not just the brain, the whole head was dead, and I know very well how much I could have kept that dog going. Along with with the IVs I had in, I could have kept him going as long as you wanted to keep that heart beating. To me, it would be absolutely nothing. And so I have signed my living will so that, as you said, Fritz, so that my family knows where I stand. But on the other point that we made about a very intense pain, and not being willing to give me enough morphine to finish it. I don't want anybody to give me enough morphine to kill me. I just want them to give me enough morphine so I don't feel any pain. And if anything else happens, that's totally incidental, as far as I'm concerned. The fact that I happen to stop breathing, so what?
But then you're putting pain first. If you have enough pain so you need more morphine to kill the pain, even if it kills you,
I would rather they think of it not as having given me enough morphine to kill me.
No.
Just give me enough morphine so that I don't hurt.
And if death then is incidental to that, let it be.
Correct.
Isn't it a proven that in Europe heroin is allowed to be given and that a patient who is suffering pain is in far better straits by being dealt with? By dealing with heroin than dealing with morphine?
I don't know the answer to that. Doctor, do you can you tell?
I think they're even up.
What's that?
I think they're even up.
Even up.
We've got about five more minutes before we're supposed to close. We don't have to close at that time, but...
Well, this would introduce an element that is not very much thought about at all. That if you go back a couple of thousand years, when the important part of the body was the heart, not the brain at all, I think there might be something to consider in looking a little bit beyond brain death. We know now in modern neuroscience that there are incredibly complex neural circuits up and down through the body in the autonomic nervous system. It's still viewed in all the textbooks as very simplistic, simple kind of thing, mechanical, probably doesn't amount to much, but there's growing recognition that this other part of the nervous system is really important, and maybe very important in emotional expression and a lot of different kinds of things. And I'm not saying that we go back to looking at the heart as the seat of the soul, but I think we're really not looking in very much depth when you say the beginning and everything is in the brain. Now that, you know, if people start thinking in terms like this, this will completely shift all of these questions into another realm.
Would you mean to say then that you would say death is when the heart stops rather than with the brain death?
I'm not saying anything. I am horrified. I mean, looking at this neural circuitry, though, which is in this part of the body, it horrifies me to think of an artificial heart.
Death is preferable.
I'm not saying what anything is in about anything. I'm just saying that we don't. We all of us have a tendency to in biomedical science and in medicine to think that at this given point in time that we, you know, we're really on top of things and we really got the smarts on things. But the lesson is that 20 years from now, or 40 years from now, people will look back upon what we knew and laugh. It always has happened that way.